From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we unpack what the state Supreme Court's ruling on the statewide Safer at Home order means for Wisconsinites. Contributor Kyle Cherik joins us to talk about the stark changes and shifting reality the hospitality industry faces.
I don't want the listeners to think that carryout is just solving everyone's problems, because the folks that are having success with it are cutting their staff by 50 to 80%.
Plus, we look at some research on how cats may be able to spread the coronavirus.
If you have the virus in your family or household, you should also be doing some social distancing with your pet cat. You hear every year about the dog that licks the man and he gets flesh-eating bacteria. Just kind of want to reiterate that kind of message for cat owners.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. On Wednesday, Wisconsin Supreme Court struck down the state's Safer at Home order, effectively removing most statewide orders concerning the coronavirus lockdown. The ruling has caused a lot of confusion. Some bars opened almost immediately after the ruling, despite, in some cases, local Safer at Home orders already in place. Since then, municipalities around the state have been scrambling to clarify or create their own Safer at Home orders. There remains a lot of uncertainty about what the state Supreme Court's ruling really means for people living in different communities. Paul Nolet is an expert on constitutional law and American politics. He's an associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the ruling and unpack what it means for Wisconsinites.
So this ruling has led to a lot of confusion. Let's start by unpacking exactly what the Supreme Court ruling has really done here.
Right. So to back up, this was a case that was brought by the legislature, and their basic argument was that the Secretary of Public Health, Andrea Palm, exceeded her authority when she issued the Safer at Home order, which built upon Governor Evers' original order back in March. And in this case, the court indeed, on a 4-3 vote, said that she had exceeded her powers. So essentially what that means is that that Safer at Home order, except as applied to schools, which was the one exception that the court made, that Safer at Home order is now no more. So the basic idea here is that individual communities, counties, cities, towns, they have the ability to have their own orders dealing with COVID-19. However, if the administration statewide wants to do anything about this, they have to work with the legislature to have any sort of new replacement for Safer at Home.
Well, and that's something that I found personally confusing. So counties, mayors, individual municipalities, they have the power to make these decisions, but the state's Department of Health Services, they don't?
I mean, it is kind of odd, practically speaking, right? Because we're talking about a pandemic. The virus doesn't know the town lines or city and county lines. So one might expect that a statewide response would be the most appropriate. But legally speaking, at least, because the court said that the state had exceeded its powers, it was limited to that issue. So it didn't address, for instance, whether Milwaukee or Dane County, whether those Safer at Home orders are exceeding their authority. Because it was focused on the state health department, this particular case, that's why only the statewide Safer at Home order was at issue here. So it still leaves that room for localities to take steps to address COVID-19.
Okay. And something that I think has been confusing in the reporting about this, and just how we've talked about it in general, a lot of people are attributing the ruling to essentially curbing the governor's power to make these orders, but it seems like it has more to do with the Department of Health Services.
Yes, that's correct. So this actually does not have to do with Governor Evers' original order, which was issued early on back in March when, you know, a number of states, not just Wisconsin, were taking the initial actions to address this. This has to do with the order that was issued in April by Andrea Palm, who's the Secretary of the Department of Health Services. And that's relevant here because the case, and actually the majority even started with this at the very beginning of their opinion, they noted this was not about the governor's power. This was about the power of the Department of Health Services and by extension, the secretary. So it was more limited than simply saying, you know, all statewide actions are off the books, because that actually would go beyond what the case actually did. This was more limited towards the April action, the Safer at Home order. And like I mentioned before, it also doesn't apply to schools. That was an exception that the court made in their decision.
Okay. So a lot of people have compared this pandemic in general to what we've seen in the past, specifically the Spanish flu epidemic in 1918. You know, I've read some reporting about this that said Wisconsin was very quick to act, and part of how they did that was at the state level making these broad orders. So when we look at previous orders that have been statewide concerning public health, how does this ruling compare to what we've seen in the past?
It's unusual. It's unusual both here in Wisconsin and then when you look at the actions of other states during the Spanish flu in 1918 and also other pandemics in the late 19th century, for instance, early 20th century. Generally speaking, states have quite broad powers to address emergencies such as this. Those powers collectively are known as police powers, and they're aimed at protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the residents of the state. And those powers are broad and really undefined. And generally speaking, looking back in the past, both state and federal courts have given states and their police powers quite a bit of room to deal with pandemics, similar to this one. So to have a court step in and say, well, actually, the public health department can't enforce any laws to address the pandemic, that's unusual looking back at the previous governmental actions to address issues like this.
To some extent, it feels counterintuitive because they are the, you know, the people who are in charge of public health in the state. You would imagine that a pandemic would give them some leeway as it has in the past. What was the state's rationale for overturning the Safer at Home order?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, I mean, a lot of the political debate about Safer at Home and similar types of actions that you see in other states, there's been a number of protests against this and such. And a lot of that has to do with what you might say constitutional issues. So basic issues of liberty, freedom, and then on the other hand, public safety. But this was actually not a constitutional case. So the majority opinion, at least some of the concurring justices did, but the majority opinion did not dive into that basic balance between liberty and public health. It was really, if you read the opinion, it's actually reads quite legalistically, because the basic argument here, the basic dispute was whether Andrea Palm's order was in fact an order or it was a rule. So it was that legal question. And the whole reason why that is important here is that if it was deemed an order, then the Department of Health Services could act in an emergency manner on its own. However, if it was deemed a rule, it would have to go through the typical process for making rules in the state. And there was some talk even in the opinion about how that would probably take at least, you know, 12 days, a couple weeks to go through the typical rulemaking process, which involves the legislature. So that was really the main point of contention here, But even though it sounds legalistic, it had a lot of impact because, again, it specified how much of an emergency action the department could take on its own as opposed to involving other branches of government like the legislature.
So essentially, if I'm hearing you correctly, the state Supreme Court said you have to slow down this process during an emergency at a time when days really mean a lot.
Yes.
As to the spread of this disease.
Right. And I mean, this is the response by Governor Evers and the Department of Health Services to say, well, that doesn't make any sense to have to go through this cumbersome process, which is typically meant for your, you know, normal everyday rules that might apply statewide. This is an emergency situation. It's an unusual situation, and it requires quick action. You know, the pandemic is not going to just wait around for 2 weeks for the regulatory process to continue. And so I think that's the response to say, look, you know, the legislature in the past had enacted public health statutes specifically for this reason, to give emergency powers to the department to address pandemics like this that have come up before in the state. And the three dissenters in the case certainly brought that point up several times, but it didn't convince the majority. The majority decided, no, this was a rule that needed to go through the typical process. Because that didn't happen, it doesn't have the force of law. And if any replacement occurs for Safer at Home, then the administration, the department, is going to have to go through the legislature.
Well, and I guess the question that I have looking at this is, did the majority consider public health and safety at all, or were they really just more concerned with kind of, you know, the minute kind of details of these rules and orders at a time when they, of course, are meeting virtually because of their own safety?
Right. So I think the response from the majority might say, look, you know, we're not saying anything about whether this public health order or rule is a good rule or a bad rule. We're not in the business of making these policy decisions. We're just interpreting the law. And we interpret this to be a rule, and the statutes indicate that you have to have a rulemaking process. Of course, the response to that is to bring up some of the points you just mentioned. Number one, you get a sense of how serious of an emergency it is when the court itself has to adjust its procedures pretty dramatically to have oral arguments over Zoom and not meet in person and that sort of thing, which obviously is very unusual for the court to take that step. And also it does read very legalistically. You know, I mentioned if the whole decision, including all the dissents, is 161 pages, so it's pretty lengthy. But if you read the majority opinion, it's almost like you don't get a sense that there is an emergency. I mean, it is a very legalistic majority opinion that talks about the distinction between rules and orders and the standing to sue of the parties and those sorts of issues. And so one response to this is to say, isn't this just all besides the point when we're struggling with a public health emergency that affects the entire state? So that really is the dynamic that I think is going on here.
It feels from the outside very much like watching them on this virtual conference call. It feels very much like safety for me, but not for thee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean I think it does appear to that way to a lot of people in the state and outside the state. And now that the court has made its decision, it's going to have to. You know, it's going to have to deal with that blowback, I think, against the institution. Unlike federal courts, you know, state courts, state Supreme Court justices are elected. One of the things that the majority mentioned here, and I think some of the concurring justices, was really emphasizing that Andrea Palm in the Department of Health Services was an unelected official. So I think in some ways they were perhaps trying to insulate themselves, saying, look, we actually do have some authority from the people here since we are, in fact, elected, whereas the Secretary of the Department of Health Services does not. Now, I don't think that necessarily you know, addresses all of the concerns about the new process for me, but not for thee issue. But that did seem to be a big thread that weaved through the majority opinion. And I wonder if part of that was to really emphasize the point that actually the court has a closer connection with the voters of the state than, say, the Secretary of the Department of Health Services.
You know, as you mentioned, there were, of course, two written dissents from the justices, including actually conservative Justice Hagedorn. What did he say about this ruling?
Yeah, it was very interesting. And I think unexpected that you saw not just the typical conservative liberal split on the court, but in fact, one of the most conservative members of the court, Brian Hagedorn, write a dissent in this case and split from his fellow conservatives. And one of the things that he emphasized in his run for the Supreme Court and has mentioned since is that the court is not supposed to be a legislature. You know, the court deals with interpretation of law. It doesn't make law. And running throughout his dissent was very much that point. He essentially was saying that the court overstepped its bounds. It was essentially engaged in judicial activism. And given that there were strong reasons just legally to consider the secretary's action as an order, so it could be an emergency, and even that the legislature itself didn't have standing to sue. In other words, it wasn't harmed directly since the legislature was the one who created the rules that gave the Department of Health Services emergency powers in the first place. Those sorts of legal issues, Justice Hagedorn said, are at the very minimum mixed enough that we should defer to the public health experts and those taking actions to address this crisis, given that, again, we're not a legislature, we're a court. So that was really his main point. And he, in fact, was quite pointed in criticizing his fellow conservatives in the majority throughout his dissent.
Which, of course, as you might imagine, they didn't really care for. How did they respond to these criticisms?
Yeah, another kind of interesting point here is that it's not always the case that all the justices will write for themselves. You know, sometimes there'll be a majority opinion. There might be a dissent that some justices join. But here, the justices were much more willing to speak for themselves, to have their own separate opinions. And in some of the concurring opinions, and essentially a concurring opinion is saying, you know, I agree with the majority, sign on pretty much totally, but I have some additional things to say. The justices in the majority use that opportunity to, number one, really attack the dissenters. In fact, Justice Kelly really went after Justice Hagedorn in a way that you might not expect two conservatives on the court to do, but much more pointed than you usually see in a judicial opinion. And also Justice Bradley, Rebecca Bradley, had a concurrence where she did get into those issues that I mentioned before, that balance between liberty and safety. She, you know, went kind of interestingly on this tour of a lot of American legal historical documents like the Federalist Papers and going back to the 18th century, 19th century, and brought up a lot of issues there that, you know, arguably went completely outside of this case, which is likely why it was a concurring opinion as opposed to in the majority opinion. But I found that interesting as well, because it was really a long statement that pressed a lot of the issues that I think some of the protesters we've seen around the country protesting these sorts of actions by government officials. It really echoed, I think, what a lot of those protesters have been arguing about.
Yeah, the response seemed distinctly political in a way. And just to, you know, go back to the case at hand here, what does the future of this case look like? Does it just end here?
The short answer is yes. It does end here. And the reason why it does is because the majority decided the case solely on state law. So it was that interpretation of whether this was a rule or an order was at the heart of this. That's a interpretation of state law. So I know that there are probably are some questions about, well, could this be appealed to the federal courts? I mean, even up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And really the answer is no. Again, it's because it relies upon state law as opposed to federal law. So as far as Safer at Home goes, well, it's off the books. This is the end of the line as far as this particular case goes. It doesn't mean that it's the end of the line for Safer at Home on the town, city, and county level, though, as we've seen with Milwaukee County, Dane County, and a few others around the state that are electing to essentially adopt Safer at Home for their own communities. So that political battle will certainly continue. The legal battle, at least on these particular issues that the legislature had raised, those are pretty much over for right now.
So when it comes to a statewide order, it seems like that's done with.
That's right. Yeah. Well, this particular Safer at Home order anyway, as the majority even said, well, this doesn't necessarily say anything about the governor's power. You know, this was about the secretary's power. And there is still an opportunity to go through the rulemaking process, working with the legislature to address the issue, which of course takes time, and time is of the essence when you're talking about emergencies. So I think it's not necessarily the end of statewide action here, but it is the end of this particular Safer at Home order and the end of this specific case.
All right. Well, Paul Nolet, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Paul Nolet is an associate professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Coming up next, we're joined by contributor Kyle Cherrick. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. As restaurants and bars have been closed around the country due to the coronavirus pandemic, the nature of the food business and its role in our lives has had to be reevaluated. Restaurants put $225 billion into the economy every year. While some are still in business, almost 450,000 independent restaurants will need to change operations to meet new safety measures or face the risk of closing completely. This will also impact the 11 million food service jobs, most of which were part of the initial flood of unemployment applications. Contributor Kyle Cherrick says that every place, from the hot dog stand to the fine dining restaurant, cannot simply stay afloat by offering carryout. Outside of operations, he also notes that many aspects of the hospitality industry could change forever, and maybe some for the better. He joins me now and starts by explaining what he's learned from reaching out to restaurateurs and chefs in Wisconsin and around the country to find out how they've adapted and what new realities they face.
I would say it is the best of times, it is the worst of times, it is the weirdest of times. There are personal stories like folks saying, I don't know quite what's next. And well, I'll give you an example. I talked to a restaurateur who owns one of the legendary and bigger supper clubs here in our state, and then a number of other restaurants in another state. And I spoke to him at the early stages of all of this, and just as the PPP was coming out. And he said, you know, I'm talking to my banker. I used to be on the board of this bank, so things change all the time, but the banker is definitely on my side, and the forms really haven't come together yet. But I furloughed everybody but our crucial or our key management. And those salaries are costing me about $30,000 a week. And I've got about 8 weeks. And then I don't know what I'm going to do. But, you know, it's really interesting to hear the stories of how people are responding. There's one restaurateur told me about his sense of success guilt because 60% of his business was already carry out. He had designed his restaurant not to be a big dining room, not to have a lot of service embellishments, essentially, certainly no white tablecloths. He's miles from that. And yet he knows lots of people in fine dining or more traditional style restaurant service. And, you know, they're really, really, really hurting. And he was saying, I'm not really down that much. And we're changing some things and writing some code for our website, but we're able to punt a great deal. And he just designed it that way because that was the style of food that he wanted to cook. The real success story within something like that would be a barbecue place that I know of in Des Moines, where on a Saturday or afternoon, they'll seat and serve 500 people barbecue. And that's in their dining room. It's a big, big, big restaurant. That restaurateur is doing more business than he had been doing in carryout at the present moment. One of the things that I would say take away from all the personal stories is that so many roads, and this won't surprise any listeners, so many roads lead to comfort food. Right now, that's what people want. And when things slowly filter back in, this is one of my predictions, is that whereas French and Italian had led the way in many trends in the past, and then sushi and some other things, there'll be a new investment in comfort food and the variations around that. And I don't think that'll go away, not because our palates will still want it. I think we'll want some of the other things after we get out of this, but it's a huge anchor that is holding the ship in place at the moment within the hospitality industry.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, there's such a wide spectrum of the type of restaurants that people can run. So perhaps they're adapting and doing more carryout if that was like maybe 10% of their business. And then you have the fine dining experience that literally can't go anywhere besides that experience of a restaurant.
Well, yeah, it's interesting, though, within that point. I mean, on the carryout stand, I was talking to a restaurateur who's got a location in this city in a pretty big footprint, so over 10,000 square feet. And, you know, carryout for him really was fool's gold, was the term that he used. It cost him more. And that's the case with many restaurants. I don't want the listeners to think that carryout is just solving everyone's problems, because the folks that are having success with it are cutting their staff by 50 to 80%. In many cases, it costs more to repackage things and to send it out the door. And that's what this restaurateur meant by fool's gold, than to make a profit with that food. So yeah, they're still in business and they have cash flow, but they're slowly dying a death of 1,000 cuts. In fine dining, I mean, there's one of the best restaurants for fine dining in America, Everest, Jean Joho. You can't get a more accomplished, famous, or French and Frenchified chef. And they're doing a $32 packaged dinner. Now, anybody that has ever been to Everest or heard of it, you know, I mean, that's not even the tax on the tax on the tip normally at Everest. And you pay for that rarefied, amazing experience. You sit at the top of the commodities exchange in Chicago and you have a view of the city and the food matches with that view. $32 for carryout for Everest. Sanford, which is not an incredibly expensive restaurant, but thought of as fine dining, their pivot has been carryout as well. So it's a real mixed bag right now. And I think we're starting to see where the dust will settle for the type of restaurants that will endure, whether they'll continue in the way that our American dining culture could evolve is another story.
Right. And on that note, the restaurant business is a difficult one to get into and manage and be, quote, successful. And even during good times, when the economy is strong, people incorporate this into their daily lives. But do you think a lot of restaurants simply won't be able to reopen due to the challenges they face?
I want to have my crystal ball. I think I think it's too soon to tell. What we're at risk at, these are things that I know. I know that we're at risk at 449,000 independent restaurants closing, changing, morphing, going away. We're at risk at 11 million jobs disappearing, or many, let's say half or more of those are part of the 20 that are filing for unemployment right now. And we're at risk of losing a good part of the $225 billion that restaurants, hospitality, not hotels, but just restaurants, whether it's the hot dog stand or whether it's the fine dining location, put into the economy every year. So those are some of the hard and cold facts. How we're going to come out of it, some of the better things that will happen is the disparity in wages between front of house and back of house may finally be addressed. That's a silver lining in a way. Danny Meyer and his restaurant group has really led the charge with that. And many people will be familiar with Danny Meyer because his Shake Shack restaurant just gave back $10 million to the federal government after their payroll protection program money came through. And he started moving his, or he moved his restaurants to everybody being on an hourly and working on a scale so that the dishwasher wasn't making commensurately less than the host or the server or the chef making commensurately less. So that disparity will be addressed. And that in and of itself is a silver lining. Where we'll land, it really troubles me where we're going to land. What we lose culturally is one thing, but with every time that we go out, and there's been this vast American expansion in the last 20 years of the restaurant industry. We've grown more in restaurants than we ever have at any time in our nation's history. So in a sense, we have a bubble like that, that perhaps could compress, and maybe it would be healthy for that industry if it were to pop in a way, but not under these circumstances, not with close to 11 million jobs lost, because those jobs are tied to healthcare and groceries and daycare and rent and mortgages and college savings and clothes on backs of kids and everything else that they're tied to for every other American.
Right. In your conversations with restaurateurs across the country, are there any specific regions nationwide or even across the state, just here in Wisconsin, that seem to be hit the hardest when it comes to the effects of a pandemic on the food industry?
Sure. So big cities are really getting hammered hard, wherever people collected en masse. Think of a city like Milwaukee, where you have a grab and go, a freshie, you know, down the street from a fantastic sit down kind of dining experience, and on and on and on, and then tied into hospitality and so forth. So that's really where the hurt is concentrated, which is not to say that in rural communities or smaller towns, it isn't also, I think, felt maybe not at the same scale, but with the same depth. I think of a great cafe in Whitewater where they've got, you know, two cafe bakeries. And I've been on panels with that owner, and she's an amazing operator, and she's got great bakery and pastry and runs her coffee game really well and really understands margins and has an amazing staff with great emotional intelligence. And she hires just the right people and does an incredible, she's a paragon of what it means to be a restaurateur. And, you know, you don't have a community when you've got that many people unemployed that can support that sort of non-essential experience. But almost more importantly, in a way, is that her cafes were a place where people gathered. In this social media and order from Amazon kind of experience that we're living in, those cafes were a locus for the community. And when you take those sorts of things out, a lot that we're not able to put our finger on starts to dissipate and disappear too. Those types of places, and restaurants have always served this purpose, going way, 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 way back in history, are a glue for a community. We lose the kind of community of standing in line, of being in the cafe, of saying, is this seat open? Of seeing the people around the same, you know, whatever it is, 2:30 to 3 time that you go after you pick up your kids from school or whatever that experience is. That's a social glue that food and beverage and restaurants provide that you can't just make up. You can't just app yourself out of it with a few clicks.
Right. And food not only is a big part of community, but of course, culture. It's how we celebrate. It's how we socialize. So how do you think gatherings around food, whether it be going out to eat or even hosting a party at your house, a barbecue, will change? Because I'm sure we'll all experience some trepidation of gathering like that for some time.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great crystal ball question. But I mean, my answer is definitely it's going to be slow. I was reading in a trade magazine the other day that speaks specifically to the big banquet world and the kind of arena space. And their projection to those folks is that they shouldn't plan on feeding a lot of people until fourth quarter of 2021. So think about that within our culture. Now that was their professional perspective. I'm not saying that that's definitely how it's going to go, but this is a trade magazine that focuses on these things and have a lot of folks studying where things will go. Relative, you know, I think it's going to change with the backyard barbecue. It's, who do you know? How safe are they? Do you really trust that they are behaving out in the world, that they're not interacting with other people and they're safe to come over? the cozy restaurant is at a disadvantage right now, because as we move back into this, they'll be moving their tables further away just so that their customers are more comfortable. Well, that just means a numbers game. That means less people can get into the restaurant, which means you can't turn as many tables and produce as much food. A larger restaurant, I guess, is in a better space that way, but it's going to be a real balancing act. So do you narrow down your hours? Do you only do dinner on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from 5 to 8? Those sorts of things. It'll be crucial that we all go out to those places because the sales will be so important. It'll be important for our souls. And the financial component of liquor sales, which restaurants can realize only at their location while we're live in the space, is going to be really, really, really important. I'm not trying to advocate for people to drink more at all, but I am saying that that is part of the engine that every restaurant works into its financial plan.
So even though things are changing, there's a horizon somewhere that we are working towards. Are there any silver linings
for us? Silver linings. I mean, so if we look at grocery, for instance, a lot of folks in that space are thinking about what they'll look like after this. And I think there's going to be some changes that have happened so quickly that none of us will ever back away from. So people have become conditioned now to ordering online and having it delivered in some way, whether it's an Uber driver or pulling into the grocery store and popping a trunk or getting it from Amazon delivered. I don't think we'll ever move back from that. So the acre size grocery store, I think, is a dying breed at this point. And I think the smaller grocery store that can cater to what's more fresh and specific will always want that experience. The design of them may change moving forward to wider aisles and that sort of thing, because this is a generational memory. This isn't just, oh, that was 2020 through the spring and summer and fall and now we're over it. This is a generational memory. But the foods that are available, I think, will get a little bit more specialized and specific. And the customer service and the emotional intelligence in grocery will ramp up quite a bit, because it can. And that's what we're going to want. That's going to be the competitive aspect. And I think that this overhaul in the dining industry, the model right now, and let no listener even wonder, the model for restaurants in America right now is forever shattered. It will be put back together in some new form. And even someone like myself, who's as close to this many personal voices, can't quite put a finger on what it will be. But I can tell you that the disparity between front of house and back of house, between number of staff that are needed, between how specials are priced and put out, between service time and service style. I think that the fast casual and the low will continue to grow. And I think there will also be an area where the more elegant and rarefied and special will actually come back in a new way. Because when people commit to going out in a finer experience, they're going to really want that. And they'll be willing to pay for it and save up for it or what have you. Meat will be king. Meat has continued to supply restaurants. The meat industry, despite everything that you see in the media right now about this plant closing and that plant closing, is thriving in this environment. There's a small spot just outside the edge of downtown that is kind of a burger bar, cafe, tavern-y thing that are doing $5 burgers, and they're just crushing it right now. Now, that's not a long-term business plan, but I talked to the salesman for one of the bigger meat purveyors in the Midwest the other day, and he just had story after story after story of successful restaurant. So meat and animal protein, sorry, vegetarians, but it's going to continue to be king. And I wish that it were vegetables, but that industry is going to thrive for a long time as a result of this pandemic.
Well, we'll certainly keep an eye on things, and I look forward to the next time we can talk in any form, whether it's this or maybe in the studio down the road. But
let's talk about something a little bit more cheerful next time, like pies or something. And by the way, everyone should be baking at home. The Yeah, it's hard to have a frown on your face while you're sitting in front of a piece of pie. Just human to human, person to person, that's my advice. Stay healthy, everybody.
Lake Effect contributor Kyle Cherik is a culinary historian and essayist. You can explore our past segments with him at WUWM.com. Up next, we look at some research on how cats may be able to spread the coronavirus. Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Many of us are sheltering at home with our pets, and they can provide us with comfort and companionship as we navigate this pandemic. But we also want to be safe and not give or get the coronavirus from our pets. Well, as WUWM's Mayan Silver found out, cats can get the coronavirus, which leads to questions about human-cat transmission. Mayan spoke with Peter Hafman, a research assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who helped lead a study on cats and the coronavirus. She asked him to explain the study and what pet owners need to know.
We've been hearing reports about human-to-cat transmission of this virus. So we kind of wanted to start fitting the other pieces of the puzzle together, looking at cat-to-cat transmission here. So we had three pairs of cats. We took one cat from the pair and infected it by intranasal inoculation, some virus in the eye, and then in the mouth. And then we housed that cat by itself for 24 hours. And then after that 24 hours, we introduced its cage mate back, the non-infected, naive cat that's never seen virus before. And we kind of let those cats live together for 10 days. And then every day we took nasal samples and then looked for actual infectious virus coming out of the nose.
And did you find it?
Yeah, so we during this whole 10 days, we never saw a cat sneeze. We did body temperatures. We never saw any kind of spike in body temperature, but we were able to find virus relatively easily in the cats we infected, which didn't surprise us. But then within 2 or 3 days after we moved in that naive cat, we started seeing those cats have infectious virus too in their nostrils.
And by naive, you mean cat that hasn't been infected or exposed otherwise to COVID-19.
That's correct.
So the virus wasn't lethal in the cats and they didn't have symptoms. Is that right?
Yep. They're perfectly fine. Never lost weight. So no, the virus is definitely not lethal in them. They shed virus for 4 days, 5 days, a good 6 days, and then it just disappears. And a good thing, too, is they can't be reinfected. So they build a very high antibody response to the virus and seem, in the short term, to be resistant to reinfection.
And are you certain, I mean, this was a relatively small population of cats, are you certain that it couldn't be fatal for some cats?
That's a good question. So, you know, we work with animals that are very healthy. Just like we're seeing in the human population, people that have comorbidities have a much worse prognosis with this virus. So we definitely don't have the capability of having like very sick animals come into our study. So we definitely don't know if that's a possibility.
Gotcha. So just like with humans, if you have some pre-existing conditions or on the older side, or, you know, you just have respiratory issues, try to keep your cats especially safe.
Yeah, immunocompromised cats, that's kind of a big thing that might be out there with pet owners. So definitely, if you are in that one of those situations, definitely keep them safe too.
So I know a lot of people listening to this are probably like, well, I've got cats, you know, what are my risks of getting infected myself from a cat? And what are my risks of infecting a cat? Can you talk a little bit about how you injected these cats with the virus and how that compares with what they would be exposed to, like in real life, for instance?
Sure. So since this was an experimental setting, they got a lot of virus and they got it directly. And one of the questions we don't know for humans is how much virus is enough virus to start the infection process? We don't know that piece of the puzzle yet either. What we can say is that you're more likely to get infected from another person out in public or from another person within your household than you are from your cat. From what other people have looked at, like at the Bronx Zoo, where a zookeeper actually somehow infected some of the lions and tigers with the virus. So we definitely can see that a person might be able to infect their own animal. But we don't know the likelihood of that animal becoming infected and infecting someone else in your household. So that's another question we can't answer right now.
And I'm sorry if I missed this, but what was the way that you injected the cats with the virus, like physically?
Yeah, so a droplet of virus and liquid in their nostril, and they suck that up as they breathe in. And then also a droplet of virus in the corner of their eye. And then also we squirted liquid virus in their mouth.
And was this a special kind of virus? I mean, I guess there are potentially different strains of the virus happening. Was there any thought process into what virus you were going to use?
So only one strain circulating, but obviously thousands, millions of isolates out there. So we're using an isolate that was from the University of Tokyo. That's one of the first isolates that we got into our lab, and it's one of the isolates that we have really well characterized. So that's the ISO that we used. But if you look at sequences between all these SARS viruses, you're not seeing too much difference. So we feel this is a good representative virus as of right now.
What's the difference between a strain and an isolate?
So isolates are just the virus from individual people that have become sick. A strain would be enough mutations have occurred that the virus acts a little different.
I see. Okay. And at this point, there's only one strain.
Basically, that's what the majority of researchers, doctors out there are saying. We got one strain circulating right now.
Gotcha. And when it comes to cats getting the virus from humans and vice versa, at this point, there's no documented cases of humans getting the virus from cats, right? Or like evidence that humans have gotten it from cats. Can you talk a little bit about that? Is that something that this study wanted to look into?
So that would be the next kind of piece of the study we would like to do, but that's more something that our colleagues that are epidemiologists will have to start looking more into, start looking at cases where there's been family-to-family transmission and finding out, is there a cat in the household or not? Experimentally, that's something that's very difficult to do. We know with a certain strain of influenza virus in New York that there was transmission of the virus from a sick cat that eventually died to a vet staff worker at this animal shelter. So there is evidence that happens for other viruses. So something that we kind of wanted to keep in mind too as we're kind of carry out these studies.
And what are some of the other questions that are left unanswered as a result of the study?
What we kind of want to know now is we have this direct transmission. Cats that are in the same cage together that have a lot of physical interaction. We kind of want to take now a step further and see if you have a cat in a cage next door, a foot away, let's say, will that animal be able to transmit virus to another naive cat next to it? So more indirect, more looking now at indirect transmission of the virus. It would be good to know at for cat shelters, humane societies, just in case the virus would get into one of those facilities, are cats going to be safe cage, or if you alternate the cages, or are they going to be okay cage if they're in cages right next to each other? There's implications for those kind of facilities.
And what should people who have cats be taking into account as a result of what you learned?
Just good cat owner practices. We definitely don't want anyone trying to give their cat up for adoption now. That's definitely not what this shows, or that's not the conclusion that people should be reaching here. if you have the virus in your family or household, you should also be doing some social distancing with your pet cat. You hear every year about the dog that licks the man and he gets a flesh-eating bacteria infection. And you're told not to let your animal kiss you or lick you or things like that. So just kind of want to reiterate that kind of message for cat owners during this time right now. If they think their cat might be infected because someone in the household is infected, you know, do give your local veterinary office a call. I know the Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab here in Madison is testing animals. So there are resources out there to get your animal tested just in case you are worried.
And what about the antibodies that you were talking about that the cats had? You know, that's something that scientists are looking into with humans. Is that something that you could get information from that could potentially help humans, or is that a big leap?
Well, no, we'll, you know, continue to monitor these cats. And I think one of the big questions out there is, a person becomes infected, does their immunity ever wane? And then that waning immunity, would that allow for the virus to reinfect them? Or sometimes do antibodies actually cause an enhancement of infection? So we can definitely kind of start testing those questions that are out there. Will the animals be able to be reinfected? And if so, will there be active virus replication or not? So we can kind of start looking at things like that too.
All right. Well, Peter Haffman, thanks so much for speaking about this.
Thanks a lot for having me.
That was Peter Haffman, a research associate professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, who helped lead a study showing cats can get the coronavirus. He spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Julian Haida and Joy Powers join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from our executive producer, Becky Mortensen. We also heard from Emily Files and Mayan Silver from the WUWM News Team this week. Lauren Sickfason is our digital producer, Jason Reavy is our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.